This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
This is The Deep Dive, and this is High FM, Friday morning, of course. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and today's guest, Terrence Corrigan from the Institute of Race Relations, and he is the project and publications manager of that organization. And he's had an interesting life history, if I could say. He's from KZN. His one degree is from the university there, and then a second degree at the University of Free State. He's worked on a variety of things, and he taught English. He taught English in Taiwan. So I guess we should say to Terrence, ni hao.
Ni hao.
For those of you who don't speak Mandarin Chinese, that's how are you? We're going to talk about elections. Now, Terrence is not, and I are not going to talk about American elections, although we might in the future. Today, we're going to talk about the upcoming elections in this country and the underlying social, political, economic substrata that underlies the way elections are going to take place, the contestation between the parties, and the challenges for those parties. And we're not in a position, of course, yet to predict who's going to win, but we are certainly in a position to be able to describe the landscape that the parties have to operate in and what that means for their messages, for their leaders, and for their followers. Terrence, thank you for joining us.
Oh, I'm always a pleasure to be here, Brooks. How are you?
I am just fine. And I'm sitting in a house which is actually colder than it is outside, but that's neither here nor there. That's a South African thing, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's you go outside with your cup of coffee and it's much nicer than in your kitchen. Anyway, here we have an election coming up, local elections. It's on if my math is right, if my calendar skills are right, it's on the 4th of November of this year. And that's one day after the American election, midterm election. So those of us who have to watch elections are going to be rather overwhelmed by busyness in the first couple of days in November. Sketch for us in a broad sense the landscape that the parties are operating in, and who has which kinds of challenges. And I add as a footnote, we also, beyond the political and economic and sociological landscape, there is this running question of how in the world the country deals with the charge of xenophobia, which seems to taint almost every discussion now. Put that in a context, but give us the larger picture as well.
I think that the operative word for the coming elections is competitive. This will be a competitive poll. I'm old enough to remember the local government elections in 96 or 95, 96. That was before the current municipal system was adopted, and a good number of both national and local elections since. At that point, there was no real debate about who was likely to emerge on top. The ANC at that stage, remember, would poll upper 60s, two-thirds majority well over a two-thirds majority by Thabo Mbeki's second term. And more than that, it controlled the zeitgeist. There were very few journalists, commentators who would stick their necks out and say unkind things about the ANC. You could go after particular political figures. You could talk about phenomena. Corruption has always been an issue. But there really was a sense that the ANC was South Africa's natural leader, that everybody had to sort of fit themselves into that reality. Business generally, my former boss John Kane Berman remarked that business, South African business, never found a government it didn't like. We had the specter of newspapers like Business Day and The Star that would offer full-throated endorsements of the ANC at election time. That's gone. And I think to some extent we need to extend a word of thanks to our former president Jacob Zuma for demonstrating just how fallible and in some respects rancid power could become. I believe that he inherited a bad situation and he did nothing to reverse it and kind of surfed along in it. But the point is that by the time he left office, there was huge cynicism about the ANC's incumbency. They still managed to sort of hang on for another cycle, but we are, I think, beyond the dominant party paradigm.
Offer a footnote to what you just said, that the country has now entered an era of normal politics as opposed to abnormal politics.
Correct, yes. A society that is as diverse, I know that word has certain implications, but South Africa truly is, on vectors of culture, political affiliation. It is an anomaly that you have a party able to secure 2/3 of the vote. Most post-liberation societies, the Liberation Party can endure for perhaps two generations, 30 to 40 years, and South Africa is pretty much hit that mark. There is polling that demonstrates that even amongst ANC supporters, the term ANC is now pretty much synonymous with corruption. They will still, I think, take a handy portion of the vote. But the idea of the ANC as the natural leader, as the undisputed hegemon, and as, to quote what an article in its journal once said about itself, the most important moral voice on any issue facing the country, that's gone from an assumption to a joke. We've seen dominoes fall slowly and then with increasing rapidity. The loss of Cape Town, about 20 years ago, the Western Cape after that. We've seen chunks of the ANC breaking off. The sort of big one was the split away to the MK party, which I think defied a lot of analysis in that it wasn't, to my mind, a particularly ideological breakaway. It was one based on personality, sentiment, and to some extent, ethnic loyalty.
Talking about other nations and other societies, the term of art has become identitarian. This is, I think, just a local manifestation of that question mark.
Right. No, absolutely. Look, the term identitarian is one that has popped up in my own writings. And I made a point about the recent march and march protests, the extent to which the signifiers of Zulu ethnic identity were looming large. I remember back in the 1990s, I was very very much associated with the IFP, and much of polite society, thought this was dreadful. The ANC was very happy to jump into those robes when it found them useful. And there was some sort of muted dissatisfaction about it. But now I think this is a warning about our politics or about politics in general. Be very, very careful about the doors you open because of the demons that will come through them. Ethnic identity served the ANC for a while, particularly during the Zuma ascendancy. And I think it's now broken into an opposition formation in the form of MK, but also in the form of a social movement. South African political scientists are very fond of talking about social movements as a sort of expression of people power, which they are. A march and march, to my mind, is just such an expression. It may not be one that you want to invite to your NGO's webinar, but there it is. Question of a foreign presence in South Africa is one that gets a lot of people excited.
Terrence, we're going to take a quick ad break. This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. Here we are on Chai FM. My guest today is Terrence Corrigan from the Institute of Race Relations, and we're talking elections. And we'll be right back after these messages.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive. We're 101.9 on the FM dial, Chai FM, and we are talking with Terrence Corrigan of the Institute of Race Relations, and we are dissecting and analyzing the social, political, economic circumstances of the upcoming election. Terrence, I stopped you in just as you were about to go a little deeper into MK and its identity politics circumstances. But please continue on that vein.
I think that identitarianism, and particularly this kind of populist us and them identitarianism, has been a feature of our politics for longer than is generally realized. In fact, it's something that I have banged upon in public recently. South Africa's kind of political analyst class has been very concerned about the rise of xenophobia, and I certainly share that. I think, though, that this needs to be seen in context. We have a political culture in which scapegoating opponents, whether it's your political opponents as enemies and counter-revolutionaries and all that sort of stuff back in the 90s, through to a senior EFF leader talking about the Indian question, as though there is some sort of question about whether Indians belong in South Africa, to a cabinet spokesman talking about an oversupply of colored people in the Western Cape, and, you know, the all of the aboves of that attended the expropriation without compensation drive. And also, do not expect this to remain neatly contained, against those outgroups that you dislike. You know, now it's come into the it's kind of manifested itself in the MK party in terms of we are for a kind of Zulu alternative, and also in the sense that it has identified an enemy that is sufficiently widely identified to, as I say, get people excited, and that is foreign nationals living among us. These things do often riff on real grievances. I think we should ignore that, and they are sometimes quite legitimate objects of politics. But I'm rather afraid that South Africa's political elite and to some extent its people need to kind of own the way that politics has unfolded, both in its good, in the sense that we are a democracy where the change of government by elections is possible. Not all quote unquote democracies can claim that, but also in its less savory aspects, the targeting of others as being central to one's misfortunes. And this is something that South Africa is taking into the coming election, and I think we'll probably have to wrestle with for some considerable time afterwards.
Part of the challenge, I think, in what you're saying is that the foreign nationals that are the object of derision or worse, they don't represent a class of voters. I mean, they aren't part of the electoral system. And so what you are really talking about, I think, is the ability of some to use their presence as a flag to highlight and explain or articulate other grievances.
Sure. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Look, I think there's two things there. On the specific issue of foreigners, yes, they're an outgroup. They are seen by many South Africans. There's lots of polling evidence on this as being untrustworthy, taking our jobs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I would encourage people to look up a podcast where Jacinta Ngobeni-Zuma is talking about this, because she is articulate and she can sort of lay out the grievances. I don't think they all hold water. But the point is that this is something that has a kind of belief and its own logical structure behind it, and if only we can get rid of this, XYZ misfortunes will be taken care of. Much the same, I think, happens with much of the other scapegoating that takes place in South Africa. Whether it's against farmers or against Indians, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. On a more kind of social level, one finds a fair degree of homophobia, which often has lethal consequences. Voting, foreigners obviously for the most part can't vote. Although when xenophobia it comes into play. It doesn't really matter what the color of your passport is. Remember back in 2008, about a third of the people who were murdered were actually naturalized South African citizens. And there are some horrific stories about South Africans being deported because being arrested in sweeps because, you know, the skin is too dark or they didn't know what elbow was in Zulu or, you know, that sort of thing. We also, I think, have a politics that tends to, that often tends to obsess about the big issues. Now, I think your audience could sort of identify with this, that there's been a great deal said about you know, what is Helen Zille's stance on Gaza. The city of Johannesburg, at its best, has no influence over that. This is simply not a competence that can exercise, except in the most performative and theatrical sense. But that is something that certain people have tried to make an issue because they are hoping that it is going to be able to excite a particular part of the voter base. And I suspect that we will have much the same thing happening with foreigners, perhaps even more. You know, Action SA, for instance, and the Patriotic Alliance are both overtly geared to geared towards this issue, and they are hoping that in this election, it will be they will be able to take their representation to the next level. Whether they will, I think that's going to be a tough question.
Terrence, I mean, this question of populism and populism stroke xenophobia stroke the otherness. Right. It's not unique to South Africa. I mean,
no, of course not.
You see more and more of this across much of Western and Eastern Europe. You see this in the United States and you see it in Great Britain. And it comes through in different kinds of ways sometimes, but it's a way of dividing a population so that who will gravitate your way can become a majority sufficient to gain control of the government. And it's sort of an easy stick to strike people with, I guess. I'm reaching for the right metaphor, as you can tell.
Right. yeah, look, one doesn't need to go to the United States or Europe. Xenophobia is a big issue on this continent. You know, there's been quite a lot said about the fears of Ghanaian and Nigerian migrants to South Africa, but both Ghana and Nigeria have expelled each other's citizens from their own countries. In Zambia, to kind of expel Kenneth Kaunda from the Zambian political landscape, they passed a retrospective law about heritage, thereby turning him into Zambia's most famous undocumented migrant who spent 40 years as head of state. True story.
Well, remember, Barack Obama was popularly labeled by some people as a
Kenyan.
Despite the birth certificate, despite the parents, despite the birth notice in the newspapers, and so.
Quite ridiculous. You see, I think what we're dealing with there is a broader problem in society. We no longer have a sense of shared information, and I think that there are various origins of this, but I think when you or I were young, you know, there were a certain number of radio stations, television stations, publications that people would read. I also think journalism tended to try, if not towards neutrality, then at least in reporting towards impartiality. So, you know, you sort of hear stories, pundits talking about, you know, my dad used to listen to PBS in the US and used to grumble about the liberal bias, but still regarded it as fundamentally reliable. I think a lot of that is gone. I think also the way that more prosperous societies have been reconfigured in the US and Europe, it's the decline of manufacturing, which gave your blue collar class a good standard of living. And I think in South Africa, well, it's also I think the decline of things like mining and manufacturing shouldn't be underestimated. But it's the sense
we were going to shift toward the economic underpinnings of this year's electoral cycle. But first, we're going to take another quick station break. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, Terrence Corrigan from the Institute of Race Relations. We will be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, of course. And my guest today is Terrence Corrigan of the Institute of Race Relations. And we are talking elections. We've been talking a lot about the texture of identitarianism and xenophobia and its impact on the way a voting culture develops. And just before the break, the influence of the way the media landscape has fractured so that every voice gets a hearing in some way, shape, or form. But there's an economic underpinning to all of this. And to explore that a little bit in the way in which political parties will be trying to appeal to their potential voters in this year's local elections, with one important thing that I want you to also explain: the continuing drop in voter participation since 1994, right, which is a phenomenon that's not unique to this country, but it's certainly an important one.
So economic matters, the kind of numbers that one needs to keep in mind is the third of the population that is unemployed, or the, you know, 42-43% that are officially unemployed but not meeting the bar of actively looking for work, so discouraged. That is just catastrophic. So by developing world standards, you know, most countries in the developing world tend to have an unemployment rate that sort of sits in single digits. If you're really bad, maybe it gets up into the teens. South Africa, this is just stratospheric. There is a vast amount of polling evidence going back to the 1990s that says South Africans are very materialistic in the way they look. They want jobs, they want houses, they want services, and they want the mobility ladders for their kids to get into some sort of middle class lifestyle. The pull of those identitarian factors is not particularly great, at least not in terms of the hierarchy possibilities. But for millions of young South Africans, the idea of getting into that economy and living in a consumer society is simply not available. Now, there is an argument which I'm fairly sympathetic to, that our unemployment rate is probably not actually as bad as the numbers suggest, because the size of the informal economy is greater. But still, you know, even if you wanted to knock it down to, say, 20 or maybe even 10%, that's a vast number of people who are not seeing their aspirations realized. The other number to bear in mind is about 15%, which is our investment to GDP ratio. Why does this matter? Because employment is fundamentally what happens when the economy expands. You expand your economy by investing. And what both the public and private sectors are saying in their actions, not in hokey pledges at conferences, is that they do not see a return on their money in South Africa. Now, there are various reasons for that, and you know that's what brings out our sort of 1-2% annual growth rate, which basically means that we are getting poorer every. So even those of us like yourself and me who are fairly comfortable in the country, we are becoming poorer year by year. What are the factors behind that? Well, one of them is the dysfunction of local administrations. The big questions, as important as they are, and I think there are some investment killers in things like empowerment policy and labor market policy, but particularly for a lot of small-scale local investment, and as I say, I just have to emphasize this, when we talk about investment, we're not talking about foreign investment. We are talking about foreign and domestic investment, and domestic investors are not trusting this country either. And investors doesn't necessarily mean, you know, guys with a sort of diamond pin in their tie and the sort of fat cat image. It's smaller guys opening coffee shops and things like that. And particularly for those smaller actors, a failure of municipal services, the quality of life stuff, that is utterly ruinous on many levels. Failure of power. You know, you can't bake your loaves of bread or operate the shears on your sort of hair shears for a barber. If you're talking about water, well, you know, that basically means any kind of hospitality industry is just not viable, because no one wants to go and use a dirty toilet. you then find that in order to try and fight this, you've got to make these additional outlays to compensate for what the government is not doing. But the government still wants its money, so you pay. You essentially, it's a case of double or triple tax. And then, of course, there's just the livability factor. And I say this is entirely perceptual, but I remember Johannesburg in the 1990s. It was a great city. And I get a lot of finger wagging. Yes, but who was it a great city for? And I take that. But I will say this. One could drive through Soweto in 1996 and then drive through Soweto in 2006, and it was a city on the move. Soweto had gone from being a sort of, dusty dormitory town to being, what was becoming suburban. And I think that's great. We were getting wealthier. It was a nice city to live in. There were distractions for your time. As these things crumble, you start to look elsewhere, whether that's abroad, whether that's living in some sort of disconnected, gated community, moving down to the Western Cape. It becomes an environment in which people don't want to, which people cannot envisage a long-term future. So, all of this is on the ballot. And I do hope to
tie this into the actual approximate topic here.
I wrote a piece earlier this week saying, yes, voter hubris is the problem, and it should be. Why do I say that? I say that because the demand that we often see, we need new leadership. Well, you're a democracy. Here's your opportunity. You can get new leadership. Go and vote for it. The leadership on offer may not be exactly what you want, but we're a society with something like 500 registered political parties, and in practical terms, something like 30 will end up on a ballot. That's more than a lot of other societies have. One gentleman in a sort of quote that I based my piece off, saying, "Well, the DA has selected their most unlikable candidate." And so, well, okay, you don't seem to be saying the candidate is incompetent, simply unlikable. And for that reason, for an aesthetic judgment, you can't make the choice. Okay, fine. But then, you've got to decide whether the moral satisfaction of not casting your vote in that way is worth, basically living through ongoing decline. These are not always easy questions, but they are the stuff of citizenship in a democratic society. And I'm very, very protective of this. There's been a narrative that's been spun for some years that, democracy doesn't mean anything if you're hungry. Well, I would say, if you're hungry, democracy may well be all you have left. And the choice is generally not that that you surrender your freedom and, the three-course meals, six-figure paychecks and whatever starts rolling out. It's generally that you're going to be poor, hungry, with no way to express it. So, yes, tying this into the vote, look around you. Are you satisfied with things? If not, look for an alternative. There are no shortage of them in South Africa. Remain engaged. It may not be easy. I personally believe that the damage done to South Africa through the corrosion of the public service, the failure to build a professional public service, laxity with infrastructure means that turning South Africa into its potential, which I would define as a successful developing country. I don't think we're going to look like Sweden or Singapore, but I think, we could look like Malaysia. We could look like, a place where your children will grow up in a more prosperous, more stable society than you're living in now. I believe that is attainable. But getting there, I think, is the task of a generation.
Think of a more complicated society than Malaysia. I mean, Indonesia, for example, a very large country,
right,
has managed to meet some of the benchmarks of what you're saying in a way which is interesting and a useful example. Same is true with South Korea, and although it's a homogenous population, and Taiwan far better than I do, and of course then there's also the example of Vietnam. Although some of these countries don't exactly have democratic processes going through their veins. We're going to take one more break. This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, the Institute of Race Relations, Terrence Corrigan. And we'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
A I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and we're reaching the sort of the last couple of minutes now. Today's guest is the Institute of Race Relations' Terrence Corrigan, and we're talking elections. And we've done a fairly wide-ranging but broad discussion of the social and the intellectual and the economic circumstances, the substrata, if you will, for the upcoming local elections. In the time remaining, let's dissect the parties and their choices and their conundrums. One thing that intrigues me is that the ANC has been unable at this point, at least, to identify an actual candidate to become mayor of John. And I'm not sure whether I attribute that to it feuding factions who all want their opportunity, or perhaps nobody wants the job among them. I'm not sure what the answer is there, but over to you. Take the parties and
give us your... But I think the ANC is staring down the barrel of an electoral shellac, and I don't think anybody particularly wants to be holding the can when the results come in. I don't think they would actually have a problem finding a mayoral candidate for Johannesburg. It's just that rather belatedly they've woken up to the idea that they are going to. So they've been trying to look for party elders, and they've been advertising that, you know, you too can be an ANC mayor, which I think that's quite entrepreneurial. But no, it is not a happy situation for them. I think whoever they actually put on the ballot, I really don't see that making a great deal of difference. The ANC, to my mind, has coasted on its party brand. I think that brand is now tarnished. They have had certain leaders that have had a particular charisma, Jacob Zuma being the obvious example, sort of opposed to some extent, but at local level, no. For a while, they even, you know, declined to name their mayoral candidates because, no, it was all about the party. I think that's the kind of zone they operate in, and I don't think they're coming out of that anytime soon. So the ANC is not going to have a good election. There's polling suggests that it's going down into the 30s overall. In Johannesburg, I think that there's a real possibility it will not even be the largest single party, which would be, I think that would be an absolutely catastrophic outcome for it. And I think that it will, it will just accelerate the sort of new round of collapse until maybe it stabilizes something, which I think might be broadly comparable to, you know, if you can think about those old Bantustan parties, fairly rural, pushing a socially conservative, somewhat populist message. MK, it'll be their first tryout, and I think that they will do well in KwaZulu-Natal. Always hinging on one big factor, is Jacob Zuma still around? I don't believe that MK, as it exists now, has much pull without the unifying figure of Jacob Zuma. In a sense, it is a textbook populist movement. It is very, very heavily wrapped around one person's identity. It is not, you know, as the political scientists would say, institutionalized. So I think watch the space, particularly in KwaZulu-Natal, but also I think a few other pockets in Mpumalanga. Perhaps some inroads even up here in Johannesburg. The EFF, I think, by-election results suggest they've had a generally sort of modestly upward trajectory, but I suspect that a lot of that comes from not being particularly not contesting a great many. I think they will maintain where they have traditionally been strong. But I think the idea that they might be able to sort of hive off as the kind of more radical alternative to the ANC, I think MK did a great deal of damage to them there. If another reason than this, Zuma personally is popular in a way Malema is not. For many of us in the suburbs, that's something you shake your head at. But, you know, as I've said, people in the suburbs don't ask Zuma to come to their dinner parties. You know, you have to sort of see this through a different lens. There's a sense that, you know, he's a guy like us. That was also, I think, why the taints of corruption and malfeasance never stuck to him with his core support. The Democratic Alliance, I believe, could well end up as the largest party in Johannesburg, Tshwane. I'm not sure about Ekurhuleni. and I think will expand its footprint around the country. I think that what they are fighting with is, in a sense, is a type of voter hubris where some of its presumptive supporters don't turn out to vote. Now remember, this is important. You can live in a ward which returns 90% to the candidate of your choice, but your vote does matter, because the overall number of votes cast does go into a pot to determine, you know, the party's overall representation. So in a sense, there is never a wasted vote. I think they'll also be fighting something else, and this is, you know, the gentleman I quoted earlier. It's the sense that somehow you don't want to go with a DA because, you know, there could be any number of reasons. You see that as too much part of the system now, or you see that as the white party, or you don't like Helen Ziller, and there are a number of the smaller actors that might be in a position to capitalize on that. You know, I think that's kind of where Rhizome, Zanzi, and Action SA sit. Bosa. But I don't think that outside of those, what I'd call the big four, there is really anybody with the resources and the machine to mount a fundamental challenge. Watch out for the Freedom Front Plus in Tshwane. My sources say that they have done, that they have profited mightily off the mishandling of the foot and mouth outbreak. But, you know, bear in mind, this is the sort of cultural center of Afrikanerdom, if you like, and many Afrikaans people have either an emotional connection to farming or some sort of family connection. So even though, you know, you and your pa and your opa may not have, you know, may have been, you know, Pretorianers for generations, you still kind of have this sense of, you know, that the place is still home. So
that sounds very French in a way.
Well, yeah, sure. Look, there is a funny strain in Afrikaner anthropology that has never quite emotionally left the farm, even as like 80 or 90% of actual Afrikaners. But you know, the idea that Steen hasn't had this portfolio and didn't take care of it, that has done them a lot of damage. And the Freedom Front, I think, is positioned to make some inroads there. So watch out for them. The Patriotic Alliance, that is an interesting wild card. In a way, I think very opportunistic. And Gayton McKenzie referred to them as disruptors. Disruptors work very well on the outside, not so well on the inside.
Terrence, we're going to have to draw to a close because I'm getting frantic arm waving from the control.
So yeah, look, what I can say, this is a wonderful time to be a Democrat in South Africa, and it's also, I think, an important time to be a citizen. So do not just watch this from the outside; be a participant.
One thing we are going to do: we're going to save every prediction, every thought you've made, and in November, we're going to make you come back here and explain why you were absolutely prescient or why it didn't happen the way you thought. How about that?
I would be most happy to do that because I can take slings and arrows. So yes, you have a date, and I have a media appearance.
We will do it. We've been speaking with Terrence Corrigan from the Institute of Race Relations, all things elections. We've covered the landscape from intellectual abstract ideas. Mr. Plato practically came in here for a little while, and then we got down to the coalface, and we looked at political parties and the economic issues. And everything in between. Terrence, it's been a lot of fun. I appreciate the conversation. This has been The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. We'll be back again next week with yet a different topic, somewhere between nuclear physics and trade policy. I haven't figured out just yet. We'll reconvene again on Friday at 9 o'clock.